Pull up a chair, the stories begin. Patrick and Randy are letting you in. From the desert lights where the big names are, it's Big Conversations, Little Bar.
Welcome to Big Conversations, Little Bar, the Coachella Valley's favorite podcast, recorded live at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert. Get ready for another fascinating hour of meeting people who make the desert city such a spectacular place to be. Now, nestled in their corner booth perch, well lubricated and raring to chat, here's Patrick Evans and Randy Florence.
Oh, that's the dulcet tones of Howard Hoffman, our announcer. Howard, thank you very much. We are back here at Skip Page's Little Bar in the very expensive real estate of the corner booth. It's very nice that Skip gives us all this. It's the biggest booth in the building.
I just realized this is not just one big booth. There's a restaurant in here.
There's a whole restaurant. That's awesome. The voice of my co-host, Randy Florence. I'm Patrick Evans. And we want to give a shout out to the McCallum Theater. They've returned as one of our sponsors. For that brief time, they were not, and the attendance apparently dropped, and the muses were in revolt. But they came back on, and everything's better now. So
Gary doing better now?
And you guys, go back to the McCallum. It's okay.
Yeah.
Just go. We're delighted to have the McCallum as one of our sponsors, and Skip Page is always great to us and the entire team here.
So you're not boycotting the McCallum anymore?
Not anymore. I was never mad about it.
Didn't have anything to do with that pyramid thing from the 70s, did it?
They didn't hear that episode.
Oh, okay.
It's probably better that they didn't. It was in the 80s.
You remember the Bay of Pigs.
Oh, that is one of our previous...
That was a callback.
I vaguely remember, of course, I remember Eddie, and he was a great interview, Eddie Gilraith from Motown. But apparently, he said to me, Patrick, you're almost as old as him. You remember the Bay of Pigs. I'm like, I read about it. Anyway, Randy, welcome. I've got John McMullen. And we are so excited. I think day one when we started this podcast, I asked Lucy to be a part of it, and she said, yes, sure. 145 episodes later.
Not for one.
She should not have been walking by just a few minutes ago.
I still have marks from the hole. Yeah,
sorry about that.
Wow.
Welcome.
Damn. Lucy Arnaz is our guest.
And I'm sorry about the hook.
It's okay. I had nothing else to do. Hi. Hello, boys.
How are you?
You're here.
I'm good. Nice to be here with you.
We're delighted. And we're excited. I had you on Eye on the Desert to talk about your new book about your parents. Really written by your parents.
Yes.
In many ways.
It's their book, really. I just officiated.
It is called Lucy and Desi, The Love Letters. And it is a compilation of their love letters that you did. You went through the editing process. And tell us how far back, like the original letters, what year approximately?
They started in the very beginning of their relationship. I think just before they were married. And then when they were married in 1940, November 30th. 1940. So that's when the letters started. And then there was the war happened and they start talking to each other about that. And then he gets drafted and suddenly he's away. And it's letters back and forth while he was in the army and he was in the hospital because he tore up his cartilage in his knees and he was in the hospital for months. And my mother was making movies and they were separated and it was lonely and newlyweds and jealous. Who went there last night? Did those starlets come down to the camp? And who are you performing? Who's your leading man? I heard you were out having dinner. It's a lot of that. But I didn't edit anything they said. I read all these letters little by little over the years since my mom passed. And they get dicey and they get a little bit sexy, but nothing you can't say. It's just very wonderful what it was like back then for them. And
it's really an amazing kind of compendium of their early life together and the timeline.
I put a timeline at the top just to give people an idea of where it was all happening in the course of what's going on in the world and of everything from their birth to their death, really. And then all the letters in chronological order. And the letters are there digitized brilliantly, I must say, so that they really feel like you can touch the original letters. And you can read them as the letter.
In their own writing.
But it's typed up, too. Yeah. It's transcribed so that it's a little difficult sometimes especially my father's handwriting.
I made a few things up.
It was fun. But I left if he spelled something differently, because he's speaking two languages, right, and he's sure. learning English. And he spoke really well, and his vocabulary was fantastic. But he was like looking at certain letters, and I think, oh, isn't that so cute the way he wrote that? Because that's the way that should be spelled. Like, we spell
that
things
makes
weird.
It, phonetically, that
like,
makes
that's
sense.
That's the way it should be spelled. And then at the end, I put a little index so that if you want to know who they were talking about specifically, and you don't have any idea who that might be, if I knew, then I would say, oh, that she's referring to the president of MGM or whatever, or Aunt Ebba, and she was from Hawaii. She's talking about her. And they're very moving. It's a side of them that nobody has seen before, because even when they're not working and they're on talk shows like this, there's still a part of you that's knowing that the public is listening and that you cover to some extent.
This is incredibly personal.
It is, but it's not. Somebody said, how dare she? Must be so personal. That I said, no, if it was like that, I wouldn't have put him out.
Of course.
It's beautiful. It's magical. And I was hoping that I would inspire other people to, first of all, do more letter writing.
Back then, everybody wrote letters.
It's so nice to have them. And me to see my mother's handwriting and where she kissed certain bottom of the pages. And my dad said, there's something very nice about your family or your best friends and how they wrote, how they expressed themselves. And so that in and of itself is historical and wonderful.
Did it come together pretty quickly the way you wanted to format it? Or did you think several different times, no, I want to do it like this?
It took me 35 years. How long has she been gone? I found these in 1989.
Yeah.
And I didn't have time then to read through all of them. There was just too many other things to triage at the time. So they go, put it in this box and someday. And then years later, I start, oh, let me read some of those. And I used a few of them in the documentary that I made in 93, Lucy and Desi Home Movie. But just like speaking them over something that was happening, I didn't really get into it. And I didn't know what to do with them. So they went back in this lockbox, really, to God forbid there's a fire. And then about 3 years ago, Imagine Entertainment was putting together another documentary. They wanted to do something. It ended up being directed by Amy Poehler. It was called Lucy and Desi. It came out right around the same time as the feature film. And I had nothing to do with it. I wasn't producing it or anything. But I opened up all my archives and everything I had for them to look through, because I said, I don't know what you're going to say that we haven't already said, but good luck, and I hope you do. So I will open the stuff, and you take a look and see. And I trusted them, and they sent it to this wonderful company in Los Angeles called Iron Mountain that digitizes gazillions of feet of film all the time. And they gave them the letters.
Oh, my gosh.
All 47 of these letters.
Very trusting.
Yes.
My gosh.
I got to know the people pretty well before I did this, and she swore to God that every time they would even change hands, somebody had to sign a piece of paper, a trail of where it went. She said, These are brilliant, and we'd like to digitize them. And I said, yeah, okay. So they digitized every single page, front and back, and the front and back of each envelope. And they look absolutely real on the page. It's what you can do today is crazy, right? And so that was nice, but they didn't really use much of them in the documentary. How much can you use? When the thing was all finished, everything that they had taken from me, they gave me back in hard drives. So all the photos that I gave them, all the slides that I had really never looked at. And in the old days, they had those 3D slides of the camera that had two sides to
click,
it.
Click,
and you see it. You had to look at it in a little thing. Mm-hmm. What do they call those deals? That you can see double slides, but it comes out as one. Yeah. What do you do with that? You can't print those. They did. They digitized
them.
And so now I got all that. And I had all these letters done. So I started thinking, long time ago, we had put together a scrapbook with the same people that run Running Press, and they did such a beautiful job of taking our actual scrapbooks and everything that was glued into them and making replicas, and they put out a book called Lucy and Desi, the Scrapbooks, where you could literally take things out of it, like a little birth announcement with a yellow ribbon on it.
That's crazy.
In an envelope that you got when my brother was born, and there's one right there, and it has its own yellow ribbon, and you pull it out of the envelope and put it back. That kind of detail.
That is crazy.
So I thought maybe they could have what it takes to make these the way they should look. And so I took it to them, and I took it to Cindy Cipolla, who is the executive editor there, and she went crazy when she saw the letters. And they have a wonderful art director, Susan, who started laying them out. My friend Elizabeth Edwards, who's been working with me for over 30 years, did all the transcribing with at our house, and we'd sit together and she'd ask questions about this, but she typed them all up, and she's the one who was responsible basically for thinking of putting a timeline in. And then they started laying it out, and they sent us versions, And it was easy. That's what I want to say. It was so easy working with them because the people were so good. It was like, I don't know. All five of these options are brilliant. So then it was like font color, what? And is they automatically went to some sort of a heart on the front for obvious reasons. But we went through several versions and I said, the version I like the best is the one that isn't really a heart. It's just created by the letters. It's created by their relationship. And it isn't, it's like a people, but it's in kind of a, it's also cut up. And that's sort of their relationship. I don't know. I love the way it came out. It's the perfect little baby that was born, and I'm very proud.
It's a beautiful book.
Thank you.
And obviously a labor of love. When people talk about a labor, this truly was.
It was.
Yeah. As you mentioned, you had a long time to sit and think about what to do with the source material.
How could I share it with people other than do this? I couldn't let people touch them, and they just, I couldn't put them in a museum. I gave so many other things to the Library of Congress, all the things that were in the scrapbooks, and they take them all off, and they steam them off, and they put them in files, and blah, blah, blah. But who sees it unless you know what you're researching? And so I didn't know what to do with them. And so this just seemed, okay, this could be a really nice thing for people to see and have. And so I'm really happy.
Years and years ago, I got to moderate a discussion with you guys about the documentary you put together back in the 90s. Right. You did a screening at the Art Museum.
Yes, that's right.
We touched on this, but I want to circle back to this because your parents, they belong to everybody now. They're cultural icons.
Sure.
And everybody who loved their shows, their lives, they feel a little ownership.
Yes.
And everybody has stories, but you have the real stories. You must see all kinds of stuff out there. And it must feel weird because they're talking about your parents, but they're talking about them in these very real terms. I know this was how it was. And you must laugh sometimes. That was not how that was.
I do. How do I say this in a way that won't offend all those lovely people? But
go ahead. Listening.
It is amusing. I have joined many of the Lucy, I Love Lucy, whatever, Facebook groups, Instagram things, because I like to see what people are saying. And we do merchandise from time to time. And so it helps me think what's current, what are they like? Yeah, yeah. And it just amazes me because somebody will say something or somebody will post a picture. And then they're all experts.
Of course, they have an opinion. So that makes them an expert.
They read something, and God, they did. They read things, which is great. They read one of the books, or they read articles, or whatever. But it's as if whoever is talking is the main expert. And they tell to the other experts, no, Rita, you have no idea what he did before that. Susan, I do know he was married before that. And then she was actually married to someone who made dog food. And it's just, it's hilarious because you can, and I can't hear them, but I can in my mind. I hear these people, and there's always one. There's always someone. I troll down for the one because if it's a beautiful picture of my mother and my father, somebody has posted, and it's, oh my God, they were such a beautiful couple. I loved that show. Oh, look at her hair. Look how the love they look in their eyes. And then the 37th comment is, he was a drunk.
There is always that one who...
And they're waiting. I'm just like, what are you waiting for? What is the point of that? But I guess there's one in every family.
Yeah. Drunk?
Or people who point out stuff like that.
I was going to say there's many more in my family.
Yes, at least one.
God, if we'd only had one.
And then I usually say something, if I make a comment, which I like to scare people, and come into the group and make a comment.
Oh my gosh.
And I make a comment and I'll say, that is so you.
I was just about to say that about my father. Thank you.
Thank you so much. How have you to say that? He was a womanizer.
It certainly bears repeating on this page.
Yes. So you had these for 35 years.
Yeah.
And now you're gladly sharing these with the world. Was there a time in your life when you had these letters and you weren't ready to do that?
35 years.
35 years
of time.
Okay.
Yeah, I wasn't ready. I had no idea. You had to do it right or don't do it at all. I wasn't sure how to do it.
And you had a career, and your career was not.
Yeah, I didn't really have a lot of time to think. So many people think this is all I do.
Write a book about your parents.
They do.
Yeah.
Are you still in the? Have you ever been in the business? They say, and I go, oh my God. But my own damn fault because I diversify a lot. I'm producing something, or I'm doing a play, and I'm touring, and nobody knows who writes about that in the mainstream. Or if you're doing concerts. Or nightclubs, there really isn't even a place in the New York Times or the Post or the Daily News that writes about that anymore. They stopped.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit like missionary work, what I do. And I can't expect everybody to know where I am or that I'm still doing things, making a living, doing what I do. I am busy, and I have three of my own children and three grandchildren and two stepsons and my husband, and we do stuff. So I don't look for things to do like this, but every once in a while, and it came to me because they sent them back digitized. And I thought, geez, okay, because that's always the way this stuff happens. It's never, I want to make a documentary about my parents. I never did that. The reason I did the first one was because my mom had just died, and part of what we inherited were hours and hours of home movies, 16 millimeter silent home movies. And what do you do with those? I didn't have a projector, a 16 millimeter projector. So I put them on VHS at the time. And little by little, we would watch them. And I thought, wait a minute. I never saw any of these. It's like my mother wouldn't show us the 10 years before we were born. That I guess she thought we wouldn't be interested except if we were in them.
Really?
Yeah. And so all of a sudden, here's 10 years of them as newlyweds and their first home in Chatsworth before I was born. And it was thrilling. It was fascinating. And at the same time, CBS had done a really dreadful trash piece that they thought was a decent film about my mom and dad's life. And it was really tabloid-esque and horrible. And bleh, it left a terrible taste in my mouth. And so I'm looking at these and I thought, geez, look at all the people they could have talked to find out what they're really like, to learn something about Lucy and Desi.
And that's, there are so many stories out there about, you must feel like setting the record straight.
Yeah.
It feels
would
a bit
do
like,
that with your folks. Would you, or you, anybody in your family, yep, somebody
absolutely.
Had the wrong idea. You say, wait, no, that didn't happen. And so I'm thinking about that and I thought, why didn't I could? I should get those people on film. I should interview them, even if I just archive it somewhere with a Paley Center or something. So I made it my business and I started interviewing Van Johnson and Ann Miller and George Abbott and people who grew up with them in Jamestown and their family members. And I had no agenda except to maybe as a daughter who was at that point almost 40 with my own kids and trying to parent and wondering how I became the person I am, the mother I am, the wife I am. And I knew so little about my mom and my dad, really. They were so busy. I didn't have a chance, and they didn't sit around and talk about all the old days with me. They didn't do that. I guess maybe that's a generational thing. Maybe people don't.
I don't know.
I don't know.
Did you accomplish it? Did you
I did. 3 years of my life, and I just sat down with all these people, little by little, and I asked them simple things. I asked them all the same kind of questions, like, what was she like when she was a child? What made my mother happy? What made her sad? What did she do for fun? Just ordinary things like that. And a picture started to form of really everything. It was very clear. And then I thought, there's like a documentary here. I don't know. And I went to NBC and asked them, why not CBS, you might ask?
Yeah.
Oh, never mind. I went to NBC and I spoke to Warren Littlefield, who was running it at the time. And I said, so we have like hours and hours of interviews with these folks, 70, 75 hours, whatever, and 110 scrapbooks and all 700 hours of home movie footage. And I don't know, it was ridiculous. It was an enormous amount of stuff. And I showed him 10 minutes of each. The interviews, the home movies, the thing. And I said, we think there's maybe a documentary here. And he said, you have Valentine's Day. That's 9 months from now. Get started.
Wow.
And he put it on. He was made us, yeah, you're going to do it. So that's how that happened. I had no plan to make a documentary. I just was going through the motions of triaging my mother's things. And that's what happens. And then little by little, you've come up with things like this.
What was the most surprising thing you found about your parents that you didn't know, other than those 10 years before when they weren't telling you anything?
There wasn't that's...
No big surprises from the letters?
Oh, the letters. From the letters, what was the biggest surprise? That's a good question. I'm going to go read the book again. I got to read it one more time to answer that. I think the biggest surprise when I first read the letters was their disappointment, their constant disappointment in each other. It was like their foreplay.
Really?
Yeah.
And was it personal or professional or both disappointment?
Just their foreplay, their flirty with each other was, where were you last night?
So
well, you didn't call. I waited until
9 o'clock.
Yeah. It was like a jealousy possession, you know, you're mine. Why are you out there doing that? And it seemed excessive to me. And then the more I got into it, it was adorable.
It was kind of their love language.
And it was. That's why I said it, like a foreplay. And I said, but I also realized they were so young. They were so young and so naive.
And how old were they when they met?
My mother, let's see, was 30. 29. She wasn't so young, but she'd been working. She hadn't really had a love affair ever. And my father was 7 years younger than she was. He was certainly, he just loved the ladies, but he wasn't in love with anybody. And suddenly they were, like Ann Miller said in the documentary, like the first time they met, they were instant kissy dolls.
There was heat.
They were magnets together. And there was so much heat that I think it superseded sense when they married very quickly, all things considered, especially considering how much they were separated in the middle of all of that. And then suddenly, boom, they were off and they got married. There was incredible passion. I don't think my mother ever had a passion for anybody like she had for that man. And the stories that people tell, even in the documentary a lot, Marcella Rabin, a family friend, told about a time when my father would play his guitar after a dinner. And my mother disappeared into another room. And when she came back, she had a tray full of votive candles all lit. And she placed them all around his feet while he was singing. It was just like, she did that. She adored him.
Wow.
And I think he adored her, too. He wrote her beautiful songs and gave her gorgeous, very important jewelry, all of which I still have. Nothing ostentatious, really engraved and beautiful and aquamarine little things and silver things. Beautiful stuff. Personable stuff. But he was from Latin America, what can I say? They had a different way of thinking about relationships.
Some stereotypes are true.
Yes. Yeah, some stereotypes are true.
Did it feel like a loving house as a child?
I have to be honest. By the time I was able to know things like that, it probably wasn't so much. But I didn't see them a lot, so maybe that's the upside.
Right.
If they were home more, if they worked from home like people do today, I think it would be rougher on us. We had the rough side was that they weren't there. And that we had reliable whoever's, nannies and peoples. But they were irritated with each other quite a lot. And that's why I was only 7 when they divorced. And I tell everybody today that after the divorce, things got really good. They did. Yeah. People, they were so much nicer to one another. And they stayed in each other's lives, probably even in a nicer way than they were before. And so I didn't like losing my father being home with us, but it was like, oh, okay, I can take a breath now. Now I'm not, I don't have such agita.
Well, especially
listening
at
to
that age, I'm a very
young
kid.
Yes, it hurts.
Kid,
you think it's your fault.
And you're also living in a house just chock full of tension.
That's right.
So there's a great deal of relief.
You don't know what it is. You don't know why. And you push all this stuff away and it cancers up in you in some way. And it comes back and bites you in the butt later on. It really does. I try to tell my kids that who have their own children now, you want to have these hissy fights with your loved one, but the way you're talking to her right now and the way you're doing, and you're doing it in front, they can't hear us. They said, oh, trust me.
They can hear you.
Yes, they can. Yeah. They're not that far away and they hear tone and there is an aura in the house that they can pick up on. There's a, when you're pissed off at him, she's pissed off at you, bubba, there's tension and you feel it as kids. It's palpable and it's dangerous and it's not their fault. And how many times do you ever go back into the room and say, listen, I'm sorry you had to hear that. It's not your fault, by the way. We're fine. We shouldn't have lost our temper, but it's not about you. We're going to be fine. That would have helped because you don't know what it is and you make up all kinds of stuff, I'm sure, as kids. So
we are going to continue this conversation with Lucy Arnaz, a really in-depth conversation about her parents in this wonderful book, Lucy and Desi, The Love Letters. We're going to talk more about some of the things that you've got upcoming as well. We're going to take a quick break and acknowledge our presenting sponsor, the McCallum Theater.
At the McCallum Theater, we believe in placing arts at the heart of learning. Since 97, our education department has inspired nearly 1 million students and community members through dynamic performances and immersive arts education programs. From the Palm Desert Choreography Festival to our Open Call Talent Project, we provide powerful platforms for emerging artists. Experience how the arts contribute to personal growth and enlightened citizenship. Your entertainment, your theater, the McCallum Theater. Learn more at mccallumtheater.org.
Welcome back. And again, our thanks to the McCallum Theater, mccallumtheater.org, where you can get your tickets and enjoy the rest of the season. And Gary has made it a point that they're going to extend the season. He thinks it's a year-round facility. And so they're going to be going a little bit longer this year, which is terrific. They're
good.
Adding shows all the time.
I want to see them.
I know you. You want to be in them.
I do want to be in them.
I know.
Gary
I know.
Keefe has transferred the Lucy Arnaz Awards here in Palm Springs to the McCallum Theater now. We started at the Purple Room.
That's right.
Oh, my gosh.
And now it's at the McCallum. So
but
that's
you had
cool.
You have a great relationship with Michael Holmes at the Purple Room.
I sure do.
He's a delight.
He's one of my favorite people on the planet.
And you still perform at the Purple Room.
I do indeed. I did two sessions there this past year, and I'm going to be back in March. March, I believe it's 13th and 14th, the weekend. And I play there. I'm hoping to play there at least twice a year, every year. It's the most fantastic club, supper club we have, really, except for maybe 54 Below in New York. I don't know of another place in hundreds and hundreds of miles from here that's as cool as the Purple Room.
Yeah. You play Feinstein's at the Nico in San Francisco.
Feinstein's at the Nico is okay. It's not the Purple Room.
It's not the Purple Room.
It's lovely, but it's not the Purple Room.
Yeah.
And 54 Below is pretty cool. They do well. And the Feinstein's at the Regency before they moved down to 54 was up more like a real class-ass supper club kind of a thing. It was at the Regency and everything. 54 is great. And more clubs are coming up, but there's not a plethora of them all around the country.
No.
I've played a lot of these clubs. They're fine. They're nice. It's what's left of show business. Hello.
But they're not the Purple Room.
It's not the Purple Room. And especially for California, I don't see where's another one like that. They can't keep them.
No, they can't. We're lucky because people attend and patronize the Purple Room because I think they realize what a value it is to the community.
Also, it's the vibe. Michael has such a great, comfortable vibe.
He
it's
does.
Friendly, and it's like the clubhouse.
You're not honoring him well by drinking your water here today.
Yeah, why? He had five tequilas.
Five tequilas show. By the end
him.
Of his show.
Yeah. I have to drive home.
It was. So did he.
I'm sure he had to drive. I'm sure he took an Uber.
Oh,
he was
my.
Fine.
So did I read... I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
That was looked important. Did I read that your name was an honor to your mother, but your mother had a different name for
yes,
you?
Yes, yes. She wanted to name me Susan. If it was a girl, she said, I want it to be Susan, because there was an actress named Susan Peters around at that time in the late 40s, was a friend of hers, and she had a terrible accident, a shooting accident of some sort, and a hunting accident. And
she must have been hunting with Dick Cheney.
Yeah,
yeah, she went shooting with Dick. And unfortunately, paralyzed for life after that.
Gosh.
And in a wheelchair. And my mother felt so bad for her. So she was trying to honor Susan, to name me Susan. If it was a boy, we knew it was going to be Desi Jr. because there were Desi Juniors going there forever. And then, I don't know, I was a cesarean. My mother fell asleep. The nurse came in, they tell me, and asked my father, it's the birth certificate. You have to sign it and please put the name of the baby. And he just went, okay, L-U-C-I-E. He named me after her, but with an I-E. So that no one would ever get confused. Thanks, Dad.
But I think that's a great story.
And it's been
perfectly
spelled wrong ever since.
that's hilarious.
Yeah. And she woke up and said, oh, it's Susan, honey.
It's Lucy. It's I love that.
This, you go all the way back to the very beginning of their relationship. And we were talking a little bit about you as a child. And of course, their relationship had deteriorated at that point, but got better after they split up.
Yep.
What lessons, you and Larry seem to have an incredible marriage.
It's long.
Congratulations.
We've gotten 45 and a half years together, but if it wasn't for him, it might have been a lot shorter. I don't know. I was still pretty inexperienced and stupid when I got married, even the second time. That was my second marriage, and I still don't think I was ready for it. And he had two kids when I married him and taking, that was a lot. And then I had a baby right away and another baby and another baby. And I was working all the time. It was a lot. That's all
a lot
I can
of challenges.
Say. And I was always felt like the guy at the circus with the spinning plates. The seven plates. And there was always one at the end that's just about to fall. And he would have to run back and spin that. That's me parenting. That's me parenting. And trying to have a career and trying to be a wife and a thing. And I don't think I was so good at it in the beginning. And Larry had been the not so good at it one in his first marriage. So he was much more patient and he had learned a lot. And he's 17 years older than I am. So he just house broke me. What can I say?
I want you to know he did a fantastic job.
He did the house training and we just kept coming back into the room and saying, I'm sorry, what? I don't know what that was about.
My wife and I have been married 45 years, and the best thing that I could say when people say, how did it last this long, is it there was never a day where we both felt like giving up at the same time.
I never wanted to give up. I never felt like I didn't love him. I just did stupid things. He might do stupid things too. I will say he never had done a stupid thing. But yes, of course. But things that you go, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that, shouldn't have said that, or oh, I shouldn't have done that, or I shouldn't have kissed that guy. I don't, whatever. You make mistakes. But then you get back together.
I feel
again
like there's a story there, but I'm not going to.
But she eventually forgave Larry.
The other love letters. Lucy and Larry, the love letters.
Lucy and Larry. I want to see those letters.
Don't tell me there's not every single other married person, gay or straight, that doesn't have the same stories. They do. But you either walk away in a huff, or you keep arguing, or you solve it and you move on and you get stronger and stronger. And now we're like freaking steel. We are. And I'm so glad that we didn't somewhere along the line go and walk away, because he's the best husband I could ever have.
No.
And he's the best father in the world. And forget all the facts that he's a great actor and he's smart and he reads and he knows more than everybody, but he's just really a great choice. And if I did anything right, it's picking him. Just the choice was good. I must have known something. I must have known something. And I've tried. I think I'm pretty good at certain things, but he's a king. He really is.
I want to get back into your career, and I want to ask you about something.
Okay.
You came close to being Rizzo in Greece.
I did.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Oh, golly. Yes, I was quite friendly with Alan Carr, who produced Grease, and it was for Paramount Studios. And so Alan called me direct and said, I want you to play Rizzo in the movie. Oh, that's fantastic. And I hadn't done a lot of stuff at that point. I was pretty young.
Yeah.
Television and some plays and, I don't know, maybe a couple TV movies or something. And
but
I was,
this is what you wanted to do at this point.
Oh, I would have been thrilled. Are you kidding? Yeah, first of all, musical and it's a film. That's just fantastic.
Yeah.
And he said, you're perfect for it. We all want you. Randall Kleiser was the director. He wanted me. Everything was good. I'm doing it. And then he said, we have to go in and run all of our choices by Mike Eisner, who was then the head of Paramount. And I said, oh, is that like he has to sign off? He goes, oh, he's going to sign off because we get to pick. We're the people who pick. But he likes to see who it all. So was it okay with you if we go and we like read a scene for him? I thought, is this an audition?
No.
It's not an audition, but you want me to read a scene for Mike Eisner.
Sounds like an audition.
Sounds like an audition to me. So I went to it as if it's an audition with my hair in a ponytail and a pink ribbon on it and a jacket and a thing. And Randall Kleiser, the director, and I read this scene, and we were Paramount in the boardroom, which is this huge long table, right? I don't know. 25 people could sit at this table, and we were at one end reading, and Mike Eisner was at the other end. And he's sat on, I don't know, I'm just a podcast, but he sat on at the table with his arm up, with his head on his chin, watching me the whole time. Never moved a muscle, much like that. And we did a pretty good job. It was a fun scene. And when it was over, Randall went, ta-da, she's great. And Mike said, the entire time you were reading that, all I could think of was your father used to run this studio and now I do.
No.
Oh.
That probably didn't make you feel confident about getting the part.
Well, so I was like, uh-huh, I was so good. Okay, thank you, I think. That's all he said.
My gosh.
He didn't then go, so, this is great. We think you're great. He just said, thank you. Thanks for coming in. And I went back to Alan's office and Randall said, what the hell was that? I said, Alan, what does that mean? And he goes, oh, please, don't worry about it. That's just that. He just, then Mike, that's just fine. Okay. So then I said, I told you when you wanted to hire me that I am booked in the summer, just same time you're going to go into filming this, to do a play. I'm going to do Bye Bye Birdie down at Melody Top for Marty Wiviot. And I said, I have to let them know by a certain date if I'm not going to do it or they're going to charge me. You have to pay to get out of your contract. And he goes, oh, no, just don't worry about that. You got it. This is happening. Okay, because I want to let him know. Time went on. I don't get any contract. They don't talk to my agents. Nothing happening. And so then I said, Alan, I really do have to let these people know. Am I doing this part? Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know what? We're just looking at different people. He wants to see a couple more people to see like how they match together. I said, oh, so it's possible that I won't. No, you're going to do this. Please, you're going to do this part. So can you sign a piece of paper that actually says that so that I can tell them? And otherwise, it's going, no, I can't really. So I went to my mom and I said, what do I do? And she says, you have to do the show. If he's not going to tell you for sure or pay the $5,000. And at that time, it was like the early 70s or something.
That's a lot of money.
The 70s for me.
A lot of money now.
Then I went, oh, geez, no, I don't want to pay $5,000 to get out of that. So I went back and I gave him one last chance. And I said, Alan, you have to tell me today, because the deadline is Tuesday. Am I doing this or not? Or else I have to sign off. He goes, well, I can't sign anything. I said, then I can't do this part. I'm so sorry. I have to go. And so I was so excited because I was going to be down in Melody Top in Milwaukee doing Bye Bye Birdie with Tommy Tune. I was very excited about that.
That's a pretty good gig.
Tommy didn't do it because
those ladies are full.
He ended up playing Rizzo in Greece.
Yeah. Rizzo, he did. Yeah, so Stockard got to do the show. She did Rizzo, which was hilarious. And
did you ever tell her that story?
Oh, yeah, many times. We've worked, and she followed me in there playing our song. She took over on Broadway after I left. But it's funny what happens with the telephone game. You tell that story, and then somebody tells the story, and then it comes all screwy. Now, if you read in all the little rag mags, it says Lucy didn't do Grease because her mother wouldn't let her. Her mother told her not to do it. She wanted to something, and I was like, no, that's not exactly what happened. But I must have told that story in some form or fashion a long time ago, and that's the way it came out.
Well, I'm glad we cleared it up on the podcast today.
Thank you, Mike Eisner is still a wonderful man. It wasn't his fault. It's not his fault. I blame Alan Carr.
It's still a weird thing to say.
It's the worst thing to say.
All I could think of was that your dad used to run the... That's not exactly what I want people to get from my performance.
The first words out of his mouth.
Yeah, wow.
It's like when you do a show on Broadway, it's like when I was in any of the shows on Broadway, and you've just done an entire evening, and you go out to sign the programs after the show, and the first thing the person says to you is, I loved your mother. And I was like, were you even at the show?
I just did a show.
Yeah, were you there? That's right.
Now,
say it after that.
Generally speaking, you've made pretty good career decisions. You almost sang as Snow White with Rob Lowe at the Oscars.
No,
I read a story.
Another telephone game.
All right.
Another telephone game. No, I did an opening number for the Oscars, okay. Much like he did with that unfortunate.
Yes. I was just going to congratulate you on having foresight.
No. I probably would have said yes. Who knew it was going to be such a disaster? I was asked to do the opening number, 1981, and I had just had my first baby. I just had Simon about 5 or 6 weeks before this, and they want me to come out, and it's a huge, big dance number, tap number. It's to Hooray for Hollywood. It starts real slow and soft like ballady, and then all of a sudden, all these ghosts from the past come down the stage, and it becomes this enormous tap number. I'll never forget it as long as I live. First of all, we were supposed to do it on one night, and it's the only time they ever postponed the Academy Awards. It was the night that Reagan got shot.
Oh, that's right.
And all of a sudden, we were ready to go. Go eat your soup, and we're coming back, and all of a sudden, we're not doing a show tonight. What? Reagan was shot. Luckily, he wasn't killed, because he actually made a video from the hospital room.
For the event?
To say, I'm fine. Have a nice evening. But anyway,
that was Ronnie. The Gipper.
So I did that.
And Jane made him.
I did that one wonderful show. And what I remember about it was that we're among friends. I can tell this story. I was still nursing Simon, obviously. It was only 6 weeks after he was born. And he was with my mother at the house in Beverly Hills. And I was down at the Music Center doing the Academy Awards show. And I had expressed milk so she would have something to feed him with and all of this. And I was wearing all those pads to wear in case, God forbid, you leak, which I've just expressed just before I go on, so I should be fine.
Right.
I get into the big, and all of a sudden I go,
it's happening now.
Fire hoses were coming out of both tits. And like four breast milk, what do they call them, breastfeeding pads?
Yes.
Stuffed into my bra. I looked much bustier than anyone would have expected. Thank God, because otherwise my pretty little purple outfit would have been. And the whole time, if you ever look at that tape again.
I'm pulling that up, right?
Watch if there's any time where my face, my eyes just get a little bit bigger.
Oh, I can't wait to look.
Because it was live and I'm singing live and I was like, oh my God.
She'll kill me for telling this, but my wife had a story where she had just had our second child, and she had the pads on walking through Safeway grocery store, and when she got home, she didn't have the pads on.
Ah, never good. That's never good. Where did I lose those?
Oh my God.
That is such a fantastic story.
Fire hoses coming out of my tits. That's the phrase.
That's in the next book.
I believe that
my
is.
My next album.
Next album.
That is going to be the catchphrase for our podcast from now
Fire
on.
Fire hoses coming out of both tits. Starring.
Michael Holmes just came up with a new project.
Those first few days when you're breastfeeding, they're pretty powerful.
You don't have to tell me.
You can aim them and get people across the room.
I had sympathy.
Yeah.
Breastfeeding.
Sympathy milk production.
Breastfeeding.
That's great. That is terrific. I missed that phase. The children were 5 and 9 when I missed all of that stuff.
That's fine.
Your parents enjoy being grandparents?
My dad died when the kids were really young. Katie, my youngest, was only about 2, 2 and a half. So my kids are 2 years apart. So 2, 4, and 6, they were very young. And they lived across the country, so we didn't see him very often. And they didn't get a chance much to be with Grandpa Desi. Yeah. They saw my mother a little bit more often. It was tough for her. I don't know. She'd never been a mom, really. She didn't have the what for to know what was natural and what age they could do or whatever. So she was very like, don't let him touch. Oh, shit. No, Mom, it's okay. He can pick up the glass. It's fine. Rabbi! She was nervous a little bit.
What did they call her?
Nana.
Nana.
Yeah, Nana and Grandpa Desi.
Grandpa Desi.
They loved them. They loved being around them. And I had my son Joe, my middle son, who was only 4 when my father was ill. And I figured Simon was a couple of years older. He could understand. Grandpa's ill. Mommy has to go to California and take care of Grandpa. Okay, I understand. And Katie was too young. I didn't want to even tell her Grandpa was. She's 2. But Joe was in the middle. So I said, Larry, I'm going to leave Kate and Simon with you, and I will take Joe with me. So he had those like a month with his grandpa, with my dad. And I'm so sorry the other kids didn't get a chance to do that, because even though Dad was sick, he still had moments of clarity and he was quite funny and he played with Joe. And Joe has memories of this, even at 4, he really does. And it's interesting that he is the one who grew up to be a guitar player and a musician, and he went into music. Mm-hmm. My daughter is actress-singer, but he's like my dad. Wow. Which is really weird. And none of that happened over the course of that month. He didn't pick up a guitar. Right. He was very ill.
But somehow it's in there somewhere.
I feel maybe my father passed and just stood by Joe a lot. Like it's his guardian angel or something.
That's great.
Yeah. It's mighty, because we went and I did an album in 2010 called Latin Roots. And I wanted Joe. He's a wonderful songwriter and he writes great lyrics. And he had a couple CDs out. And so I said, hey, you want to give me a song for the album, I'll put it on. Is there something I could sing of yours? He said, I don't know. Let me think about it. Or maybe I could write something. And I said, yes, please. So he sends me a beautiful track, a haunting melody. And there was no lyric. And I said, this is great, but where's the lyric? He said, I don't know. I didn't want to write it. I don't know what I was supposed to say. Really? Because you write great lyrics. And he said, but I don't know, Mom. What were you thinking about, Joe? When you were writing the music, what were you thinking about? And he said, I guess I was thinking about Grandpa Desi, of course, and I was wondering, does he know that I play music? Does he know that I'm a musician? Does he hear me? I wish I could ask him about the band business. I wish I could ask him about music and see if he thinks it's any good. And where do you go when you die anyway? And I said, whoa. Okay.
That turned into quite a conversation.
This is a lot. And I said, okay, so I write lyrics from time to time. Let me take a crack at it. Maybe I can answer some of that. And it became The Music in Your Heart on my CD. And I swear to you, it's my favorite cut. What he wrote, and then he played guitar on the cut and ukulele, overdubbing the ukulele that he plays. And I sang it, and it's really good. And I just love it. I'm going to do it in the show, actually, February.
Can't wait. Let's talk about
The Plaza.
You've got a couple of things coming up. But The Plaza, you're doing your big band show at The Plaza.
Yes, I'm going to do a big band show. It's not any big band show they've seen before. It's put together specifically for this night at The Plaza, and it's called Sing Happy. But it's a compilation of some of my favorite charts that I've done over the years. So it's a little bit of everything. And I'm doing a big chunk of my dad's music. A little reflection back to doing the Latin Roots show at the McCallum, what I did twice there. And I'll be doing Joe's number. Mm. And I'm doing some things that reflect my relationships regarding Palm Springs, living here and the people I know here. A tribute to David Zippel, a tribute to Barry Manilow. And I wanted to put this show together with all that's going on in the world. I don't know if you've heard.
I read there's some stuff.
I've had these headphones on, so I've missed a lot.
There's stuff going on. And part of me was saying, like, why are you even thinking about getting up on a stage and performing and singing and dancing? It's so mundane. And what, you're so tone deaf. Like, you shouldn't even be doing this. You should be marching. Don't, what is, why? I don't know why. I just felt like, why are you doing this? And I almost didn't do it. And then I realized that Larry and I, with all the stuff that goes on every day, and every, you read the paper, you go on radio, TV, it inundates you. It's so much. It's overwhelming. And very few times do you feel you're in any kind of control where you can do something about it. Yeah. And that's what's the hardest part. Boy, when they canceled Jimmy Kimmel, we knew what we could do. We could cancel Disney and Hulu, and we felt powerful. And it worked.
It did.
And you can march in the King's March. Boom, there's something, give us something to do, and damn it, we'll do it. But what is this? But I go home after one of these crazy days that we have every single day, and Larry and I just want to watch something funny. We want to listen to music. We need a minute. We need a minute to recharge our batteries so that we can start again the next day and fight the good fight. And I thought, other people need that too. So we're, as I said before, it's like missionary work. It's like you're in a USO show and you're going out there to entertain the troops because they have to go to the battlefield. Yeah. They have to continue
fighting.
Listen,
you get the opportunity to put the energy out that you're putting out. That does help.
I agree.
The collective. So thank you for that.
You're also doing a show on December 8th. You're part of the Icon Show.
I'm not actually doing a damn thing. They are honoring us and we just have to go up and accept this. And there's wonderful little videos of us. I hear
phenomenal.
That Jim Cook has put together, and I don't think we're doing much of, nobody's asked me to do a thing, but okay, Billy Stritch is playing and hosting.
There's a three-act play that you're performing.
I hope they send me the sides soon.
Okay. Billy Stritch, we love Billy Stritch.
Yeah.
He was a guest on our podcast, and he's so good.
He's fantastic.
You mentioned David Zippel. I just interviewed him. It was all too brief, but we did an interview because he's got a play series coming up at the Plaza.
Yeah.
And he is
Replay. I'm in one of them.
Yeah. Oh.
That's another thing. So we're doing the 8th is the Icon thing. And then there's my show. And then at the end of April, in the very first few days of May, I'm doing one of David's Replay play readings.
Yeah, there's stage
readings. Yeah, I'm going to see the one with Richard Kine.
That's the one I'm in.
You're in? Seriously? Oh, that's going to be fantastic.
The only female part in that show.
Oh, yay.
Yeah. Richard Kine.
And Jason Alexander.
Jason and Dan Bukatinski.
Oh.
Who I adore. And Richard Kind and I did Dirty Rotten Scoundrels on Broadway together.
There is nobody who makes me laugh the way Richard Kind
does. He's a very funny guy.
Yeah.
Very funny guy. And he's very good friends with George Clooney. And that's really the only reason I love him.
They lived together for a while. I heard the story of his cat.
I just want to meet George Clooney. I told him that. I said, I don't really like you, but I want to meet George Clooney.
That sounded just like him, too.
Together in a romantic sense? Or are they dating?
George was a struggling actor. And
well, they're roommates.
And they were roommates in a...
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Ratty apartment.
We're due to actually have David Zippel on the program early in 2026. So
he's going to be promoting all this stuff, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. His business is about to take off then.
Yeah, he's going to be on super busy.
I just want to warn you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Any more of those
you won't be able to walk outside.
Get me a guard.
He won't need
any
more of those checks from Disney.
Yeah. He probably doesn't even cash those anyway. It is rare that I do a podcast without bringing up Star Trek.
Okay, that's fine with me.
And this is also one of those things that on the internet, if you're in a Lucy group or a Star Trek group, there's always this talk.
Sure.
But explain what your mother's role was at the inception of the series, because she was a key figure. A lot of people ascribe great deal of credit. Some people know she was totally hands off. What's the real story?
If you say she saved Star Trek, that would be honest. That's true. It was a script that came to Desilu Productions. Just before she sold the studio, really, it was after my father had left, but it came to them, and they did this. They did the pilot, and they also did Mission Impossible, and they did Mannix, and they did a bunch of stuff. And then they have a big board meeting. My mother's now running the studio, not my dad, which she hated doing. And she's having one of these budget meetings, and the suits are telling her that there's too much money going out, and they're going to suggest some cuts. And a couple of the cuts were Mannix, Mission Impossible, and Star Trek.
Three incredible shows.
Yeah.
Good golly.
And she said, maybe she didn't say it like that.
It wasn't too far off, though.
What does that sound like? sounds like Mae West. She said, you know what? Gary really likes Star Trek. He loves that show. I don't want to, I don't think they should cancel that. And then she said, Mission Impossible. I think they're great. Don't you like that? He left.
Fine.
So they all survived. Mannix, Mission Impossible, Star Trek, because she just didn't have the heart to cut them. And bingo, apparently you know more than I do, but Star Trek got lousy reviews or was not going to go a second season.
It wasn't going to go. Remember being in tears as a 11-year-old or something because the show was about to get off, come off the air.
No, letter writing saved it a couple of different times.
Yeah.
But Lucy's...
But that's her main connection to it. As a matter of fact, they're doing a Lucy figurine for something Star Trek is doing, and they're making a little action figure of my mother to be put next to Gene Roddenberry.
Oh, that's phenomenal.
Because they want to say those two people are why we have Star Trek, which is hilarious.
Wow. That's very cool, though. And then her son-in-law goes on to star in one of the movies.
How about that?
Yeah.
Who knew?
I was thinking about it. I actually went to see William Shatner do a thing.
Yeah.
And, of course, he directed Larry in that film.
Yes,
so
he did.
I was thinking about that.
I had the honor of doing a scene recently that was one that Larry did from a play called The Shadow Box.
Oh, my gosh. Sure. Yes.
And it was a pretty incredible scene.
Yeah.
I wish I'd gotten to see him do it.
I wish I'd gotten to see him do it, too. Wait,
while we're telling stories, John, you had a story.
Yeah, John.
About meeting Lucy's mom.
I did. It was, I'm going to say, maybe 1982 or 83. I was with a friend in Los Angeles, and we decided to go to the NBC studio tour, and we were also trying to get tickets to go to a taping of Bob Hope Christmas special that night. And
in Korea?
What?
Korea War was over by 82.
In beautiful Mash downtown Burbank, I'm sorry.
Maps are still off.
So it turns out that we got to do both, and while we were on the tour that afternoon, as we're walking down this one big corridor between studios and like some rehearsal halls on one side of the wall and the studios on the other, Lucy was in dance studio or something. It was some rehearsal hall with some other people and they were practicing some dance number. And as we were standing there and the page was talking with us about all the stuff that happened in these various rooms, she stepped out and I was stunned. This was the first real major celebrity I had ever seen in person. And you know what stuck with me was that my mom was a redhead, but she wasn't that much of a redhead by comparison. I just remember
Neither was mine.
I just remember how bright your mom's hair was that day and going, holy smokes, that could light up a cave.
Your mother could have bought that too. Hey, you just got to know the number.
Yeah. Anyway, it was a really cool experience. And I wasn't even 21 yet. Yeah.
Did you speak? Or just saw her?
No, we actually got to talk with her for a few minutes. Nice. So it was really nice because she came over to the group and introduced herself and very cool.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Nice story.
Now folks can find out all of your performances. It's lucyarnez.com, correct?
Correct. There's a calendar there and I haven't got a whole lot booked coming up in the next season. I've been staying home trying to write and I wanted to spend more time with Larry and my grandkids. So I've been very circumspect about the things I say yes to. Plus, I'm not nuts about flying right now. Call me crazy, but it's making me a little nervous. And I'm a good flyer, usually. But I'm a good flyer because I trust air traffic controllers and maintenance. The two things I don't trust right now. How do you get to the gigs if you don't fly?
Didn't you not just take a cross-country trip on a train?
Because I wouldn't fly.
With Sue Cameron, yeah.
Yes, with Sue. Because I had a gig booked in May, the middle of May in New Jersey, a huge, big outdoor thing. And how am I going to cancel that? And a lot of people, and wasn't chicken liver money. It was good. And so I thought, I have time. I could actually train it. I could take a train.
How'd you like that?
I liked it. I've done it before. I had to come from California, from New York to California right after 9/11. We were producing the 150th anniversary of Lucy special, actually. And I had to be there, but that no planes were flying, of course, after that. And they said, you got to be here Tuesday. So they put me on a train. And I loved it. The train from New York to Chicago was a really cool, very nifty little cabin roomette. And I did a lot of work on the train. I worked on transcripts and things. Then the train from Chicago to California, not so much. It was like an old fashioned, the room was dirtier and older and meh. But I did enjoy that trip because I got to sit. I was all by myself. So when you go to the dining car, they put you with other people. They make you sit. There's everybody has to be four at a table. Hi, I'm Lucy. And you, hello, hi. How do you do? Hello, hi. And, you know, it's, but I was lucky because it was right after 9/11. We had plenty to talk about.
Yeah.
And you can't believe the stories. I actually have a notebook somewhere with, I would go back to my little roomette and I would write down all these amazing things I was hearing people talk about what happened to them. Or some people were the only ones left in their company because they didn't go to work that day and they were going to Chicago to restart the company in another
way.
A lot of sad stuff and really crazy things. So I hadn't done a cross country since then. And it was fun. We got two little roomettes. And they're tight, they're small, and I don't think Amtrak takes a whole lot of care about their tracks like they used to. No, I found out it's because the trains that carry the cargo trains, right?
The freight trains.
The freight trains have priority, and they own the tracks.
Yeah,
Did they own the tracks?
Yeah, Amtrak leases the
space. So the people who work on the train said, yeah, they own them, and they don't really care because there are no people in the back. So if the train goes side to side and bumpy, 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 and around a corner and things, they don't care. It's jars of soup. We don't care. So it was different, I think. And there was a lot of that, a lot of motion. And sometimes it got comical. I was sitting, Sue's room and my room were right across this tiny little hall. The hall was not as large as this little table we're sitting at here. And she's standing there and the door to her little room is there and mine is there. And we're saying goodnight, goodnight. And tomorrow I'll wake you up. And the train did one of those, they're changing tracks or something. She went flopping into her room. She just flew away and face planted in a bunk with her feet up in the air. And I laughed so hard. It was hilarious. But we met a lot of nice people. And I would do it again. If you have to have 6 days, if you're going to go cross country, and you have to have $6,000 if you want a roomette. It's not cheap. It's like flying first class on Dubai Air, but with worse food.
Yeah. Wow.
So, can you imagine the stories over 6 days between Sue and Lucy, though?
Oh, I would love to have been a fly on that one.
She kept trying to pretend she was someone else.
Really?
Like she said,
she's not happy with who she is.
I don't want to be me. When we meet these new people, let's pretend that I'm, who should I be? And I go, you're you. You're a journalist. What do you care? Of course, tell you have great stories. I don't want to be me. I said, you don't want to be you? How about me? I don't want to be me. You think you don't want them to ask you stories?
You should flop.
What is wrong with you? That would have been hilarious.
Oh, my God.
How many times can I sit there and say, hi, my name is Francis, and have them go, you don't look like that. You look familiar.
You look really familiar.
You look really familiar. And I've said that to somebody said, you look really familiar. And I go, Lucy Arnaz.
No, that's not it.
No.
I get that a lot.
Yeah. No, they go, no, that's not it. Okay.
That is hilarious.
I just can't wait to hear this back. I just want to hear the pit story. That's really
That's really the high and the low point of the show, really, I think. Is it? Thank you so much.
Is it over? Do I have to leave?
No. What else would you like to talk about?
No,
I feel like we've really just scratched the surface.
You're absolutely right. Any subject at all. Nothing is taboo.
I've got to write a lot more questions and get her back next week.
There you go. No, we could have talked for forever.
Then will you come
back?
You're
fun to talk to. Of course, anytime. It's fun to... Michael Bennett, who Chorus Line, Michael Bennett, who created Chorus Line, he once told me never ever to do any more talk shows. Certainly no more game shows, Lucy. And he says, you don't do those. Don't do those. He says, you're a theater person. We don't do that. And he says, and you can't go on a talk show unless you have something specific that you're trying to promote. You just don't go on and chat.
When did you do game shows?
I always thought about that. Oh, yes, and I loved them. Yeah. And he made me not do them anymore. My favorite was the Pyramid Show, $100,000.
Yeah, Dick Clark.
I tied with Tony Randall for winning the most money for their contestants. We both won like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. It was one of my favorite shows to do ever. I love that show. I love Password. I was little when I was actually on Password, but I love to play it, and I love charades. I love playing.
We got a whole nother episode.
I think the first time I ever saw Lucy on television was probably on
something like Match Game or Pyramid or one of those silly things. I did celebrity bowling. Come on. With my then newlywed husband, Mimi Hines, Phil Ford, and Phil Vandervoort, and Lucy Arnaz. And Mimi and I have the same birthday, which was hilarious. And their names were both Phil. So we thought that was just adorable.
Could you bowl?
I was pretty good.
Yeah.
Actually, it was pretty good because Edie, my stepmother, knew how to bowl, and she taught Desi and I how to bowl. I had my own bowling ball.
Randy.
Initials?
I had No, it didn't have my initials on it.
Should have. Absolutely.
Okay, if you say it was your, I believe you.
It was a sparkly, ridiculous color that no one else would dare touch.
Did you have your own shoes?
I did. I had.
So you were real. You were a bowler.
Yeah, we went bowling down when we would spend the summers at Del Mar, and Edie would always take us bowling.
There's a.
I'm full of surprises.
I want to party with Delmar Lanes is still looking for their sparkly ball.
Delmar Lanes.
The one without the initials.
That's right.
Oh, my God. This is true. All right. I'll be a good person and I'll leave.
No, we have to go, but you're welcome to stay.
No, you just had to, seriously, we have so much to talk about, but I really wanted to get you on prior to your performances at the Plaza.
That's great. And there's a few seats left, but not too many. I have a friend who called me this morning and said, are those the only seats left? Are they not holding any back? I said, I don't think so, but okay. There's still about 60 seats left. And I'm telling you, I've been in that theater a lot recently. There isn't a bad seat in the house. Even upstairs in the balcony, in the mezzanine balcony, it's beautiful. It's an intimate, wonderful, 800 seats, but it doesn't feel like that. It feels very intimate, and the sound system is going to be incredible. It's all brand new. Everything's
so
brand new.
Give us the date.
February 18th, Wednesday night, February 18th at 7:30, I believe. It's a 7:30 crew. It's called Sing Happy, and it's me and an 11-piece band.
Wow.
And Ron Abel, musical director.
All right, we want you to go to that on the 18th. We want you to pick up the book, Lucy and Desi, The Love Letters. It really is just spectacular. Thank
it's
you. Beautiful.
Thank you.
And if you are a Lucy or Desi aficionado, this will give you truly the inside story in their own words and lovingly put together by their daughter. So it's just really, it's a spectacular piece
Thank
of work.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I found a lot of people buying more than one at the book signing the other day because they said, I got to buy, it's my favorite. My mother loves this. Or it was like for Christmas for my sisters. And also five sisters showed up and all from different places in California, but they all decided to come to this because, and they showed me a picture, they had found a box the size of this table, way more than what I found, this little pack of letters here. Hundreds of letters from their mother and their father, the same kind of thing.
Oh, I thought, wow.
That's really cool. Of course, other people have these, not
That's
just
really
me.
Cool. Yeah.
And they were saying the same thing, how great it was to be able to touch them and to see their handwriting and the little ways that they would talk to each other, but they would never be like that at home. And it's a side of your folks that you're not going to see.
And
right?
the things that they would write that they never imagined anybody else would ever see.
Exactly.
So they were pretty detailed and intimate. And
they said, but how are we ever going to, we'll never get through all these. I said, well, you got five sisters here.
Yeah.
Split them up five ways. And I said, that's my advice to you, is it deal them out five. Here's one for you, one for you, one for you, one for you. And all your letters, then you take them home, you read them, and you transcribe them and digitize them. Now, you'll have them digitized if you do it on your computer, and then you can make a book for everybody, and your kids and your grandkids. And they went, that's a great idea. And I said, see, I'm not the only one who can do this.
Get the book. And kudos, by the way, to the good folks at Just Fabulous, because Stephen does such a great job.
He did a magnificent job.
Yeah.
He served people Prosecco and cider and food and things while they waited in line in the rain.
Yeah, I know. It was a wet day. Hopefully you'll be doing another book signing.
Yes, I'm going to do the Rancho Mirage Writers Festival in January.
Oh, cool.
January 29th, I'll be interviewed by David Zippel.
Oh.
Actually about this book. And then the next morning early, I'm going to do a conversation with Todd Purdom, who just wrote a fabulous book about my father, the best thing ever. It's called Desi Arnaz, The Man Who Invented Television. Thank you very much. And it's a beautiful book. And so they have him and I kind of conversing about this. And it's Dave Karger from TCM.
Yes.
Is going to do the he's going to be the moderator. And then there'll be book signings after both of those. Yeah, but I'm not doing a lot. I told them I'm not going to go out there promoting this. It's my book. It's not my book. It's theirs.
Their book.
Like the scrapbook was theirs.
Theirs.
And I just officiated it. Like I said, I made it happen. I made it possible. That's all. And I wrote the foreword, which is a pretty good foreword, I must say.
Oh, I can't wait to see.
Yeah.
All right. The book, the performances coming up at the Plaza Theater and in March at the Purple Room. Go to lucyarnez.com. Thank you so much.
Yes. You're the best.
Thank you very much.
It's always
Thank
so
you
fun to spend
Thank
time
you.
With you.
It's nice to be here. I loved it.
Randy, great job.
It was a fun one, wasn't
Your
it?
Research is impeccable.
Yeah.
John, thank you for the personal Lucy story. That was terrific. And our thanks to the McCallum Theater, our thanks to Skip Page and his entire team here at Little Bar. I'm Patrick Evans. This is Big Conversations, Little Bar. Please subscribe so you never miss an episode.
Big Conversations, Little Bar is a production of the Mutual Broadcasting System. This podcast is available in audio and video format. Visit our website at www.bigconversationslittlebar.com. New episodes are released every Monday.
big conversations, little bar.